We're talking about racism as a public health issue. A current report from UW Population of Health Institute shows health inequities are rooted in racism. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. More than 40 groups have signed onto a resolution that acknowledges racism as a public health crisis. We're talking about how to talk about it and what we can do to lessen disparities in our state. Join the conversation. What do you think? What have you seen as far as racism affecting people's lives? Do you believe that it's a public health crisis? Or what questions do you have about that kind of a declaration? You can give us a call. Email ideas@WPR.org or use the phone at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Pam Goodman. She's a clinical assistant professor in the College of Nursing and Sciences at UW-Eau Claire. And Pam is part of a statewide effort that resulted in the Wisconsin Public Health Association declaring that racism is a public health crisis here. Pam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you.
How can we say that racism is a public health crisis? What dots do we need to connect to recognize that that's just true?
Well, you know, the social constructs of looking at what we call the determinants of health are really a huge part of racism. When we talk about this from a population health perspective, we're looking at how do communities of color, ethnicities, where are they located, such as in housing? What has been the opportunities for education? What about transportation? What about equitable opportunities to live in neighborhoods that are safe and provide the best opportunities for everyone to be able to maximize their optimal health and well-being and contribute back to society? This is oftentimes difficult to talk about, and especially when we use the word racism, a lot of people really have some challenges in thinking about, well, you know, what about my own personal situations, or how does that relate to what I believe in, or how does that relate to my own ability to obtain health? But when you start to pull apart the issues around racism, we can recognize that it has a lot to do with power and the social constructs that we have in our society today. And that really affects health, because if you're not able to have these things as part of your own life and well-being, your health starts to suffer, especially over many decades and time that goes on. But we're seeing those effects today.
And there is certainly the conversation about opportunity that goes in so many directions. One thing we do know, though, is that when people experience these, the lower end of disparities or inequities, someone's physical health changes simply because of the stress.
Absolutely. And we see this, you know, in our, especially our African-American birth outcomes. Our infant mortality rates are horrible with our African-American babies. The ratio is, you know, twice the amount for those who have been that are born premature with our African-American babies. We see these disparities, especially so for African-Americans and other minorities in regard to the effect of obesity, cardiovascular disease, strokes, diabetes, and those equitable opportunities are not available because they haven't had as much of the ability to have equitable options, I should say, or opportunities where they can, you know, get to the healthcare that they need. And over time, as you mentioned, the stress that is involved as there is less opportunity for them to be able to have enough equitable opportunity for their housing, that ends up being very stressful. And we see this in the long-term outcomes.
Pam Goodman holds a doctorate of nursing practice, and we're talking with her about how racism is a public health problem. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you part of this initiative? Do you see this happening in your communities? What makes you think that the state needs to address this issue? Or do you think that it should be on the individual to somehow figure out how to make this public health crisis better? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also always email us at ideas@wpr.org. Pam, let's springboard off of what you were just talking about. We have, higher death rates for African Americans and Native Americans at all stages of life in Wisconsin compared to other ethnicities. How do inequalities and disparities specifically factor into that? It's baked into our system.
It is baked into our system, and we have to disentangle all of that power, because when we have our system set up so that there are disadvantages for certain parts of our population, there is just little opportunity for them to be able to reach for that highest level of health. And so when we start to disentangle this, and from a statewide perspective, we have to do this. We have to do this for all communities, because when all of us are much healthier, we all are able to obtain a better, equitable way to also give back to our communities. So when you asked whether or not if I'm part of this statewide initiative, I am. And part of the task force that I have been on is about how do we talk about racism, and can we develop the language and the narrative about how we talk about racism? And, you know, I'm a low middle class woman, middle aged, and, you know, these are things that I am really working hard so that I can have better discussions. But I have to say that from a rural perspective, I have witnessed this with my own eyes. I'm a public health nurse. I like to be out in the field. I'm out in the communities. I've worked many, many years with people on the ground. And when you see what happens to people because of the stress that they have endured time and time and time again, and you recognize the inequities, it is time for us to do something at all levels, whether that's at an individual level, joining, being willing to listen to people who have experienced these types of disparities, also joining task forces, and just really understanding that we are all in this together. It's just really so very important.
I think it's striking, though, that not only do we see racism affecting people's emotional health, but it affects their physical health. Just years of suppression, something like feeling that leading to higher levels of hypertension. And then if you're having a baby, the likelihood of premature birth increases. I mean, there are real physical issues that come out of this.
Absolutely. And I think when we first started, I mentioned that our African-American babies have the highest percentage of preterm births at about 11.1%. That's twice the amount for us as whites. Also, for the national infant mortality rates in our Native Americans and Alaskan Natives, they have a 60% higher infant mortality rate than whites. And that's 2014 data. So we know that these types of challenges occur for our health outcomes, and in addition to our mental health. The MMWR, which is out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2017 noted that the health status for the quality of life is that's fair or poor is at 28.8% for blacks versus 18.5% for whites.
Yeah, so you can hear that difference. Pam, I want to jump in here. We're talking about racism as a public health problem with Pam Goodman. You're part of this conversation. Maybe you work in healthcare. What do you see as far as inequities and disparities and how that affects families' health? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Health professionals acknowledge that housing, transportation, and education are all factors that affect a person's well-being. So when people are at a disadvantage in those areas, their health suffers. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to hear from you. Do you work in healthcare, or do you see people being affected by racism? What do you consider the root to be the root causes of this inequity that we have across races when it comes to health and wellness? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Maybe you see solutions to some of the challenges that we have in even starting the discussion about racism as a public health crisis. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest is Pam Goodman. She holds a doctorate of nursing practice, and she's also a clinical assistant professor in nursing at UW-Eau Claire. Pam, let's talk a little bit more about your personal connection to this. We've seen 40 different organizations sign on to the declaration that racism is a public health crisis. You've also signed on personally. And why did you make that distinction?
Well, I have primarily focused for nearly 30 years of my nursing career in public health. And I signed on personally because I understand as best as I can from a rural inequity perspective. And rural inequities, and for those who are of minority African-American that also are rural, the disparities for health outcomes is even worse. And so when I obtained my doctorate degree from the University of Minnesota, a lot of my training and education had to be along, not had to be, but had was along these similar lines around those determinants of health that you just mentioned. And I joined a health equity narrative work group, which is one of the three factors that we are working on to try to advance health equity in the state of Wisconsin. So when I looked at the declaration that the Wisconsin Public Health Association, which I'm also a member of, had put together, it identified everything that I have learned. It's also very personal to me as having been an advocate for rural populations for the last three plus decades. And so that's part of the reason of why I joined on. Plus, in addition, you can see that the challenges are increasingly worsening when we are not addressing these particular issues in healthcare.
How should we think about the nexus between the issues that face people in rural areas of the state and racism? We know that many of Wisconsin's minority populations are condensed in bigger cities.
Right, but the when you really start to pull apart the issue around racism and you start to understand the significance of power, and for those who haven't had the ability to have their voice heard, to be listened to, we start to understand that there are extreme similarities to this power that has been centered around white privilege, and primarily more of those who have a lot of wealth and power in powerful positions that really haven't been encompassing of the voices that need to be heard. And I think about this from a previous administrator experience that I had as a community action agency director. And this is something that community action agencies, anti-poverty organizations really try very hard to help provide equitable and also the opportunity for people who have had suppressed voices to really have them be part of the conversation, to really take hold of the power themselves and to empower them to become part of the solution to really change the narrative and to change the outcomes that we so desperately need in our state and across our country.
Pam Goodman is a population health nurse educator, and she teaches at UW-Eau Claire. And there's room for you in our discussion about racism as a public health crisis. Have you experienced health inequities? How do you see that your opportunities are different than those of other people? Do you consider yourself part of a minority population? What do you want other people to know? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And we have Tom from Burlington on the line as part of this discussion. Tom, thanks for your call.
The hidden cost of racism is poor people have a poor diet. They can't get access to good food. they can't get access to good jobs either. We don't have, we didn't build a light rail system in Milwaukee to get people to the suburbs, because it's really racism that holds them back and surrounds them. In the poorer districts of the city, people substitute bad food for good food. We don't have supermarkets there that are going to give them good food. And this costs us, the bad diet costs us, they say, $1 trillion a year. It's a hidden cost that people aren't aware of. And it's just so sad that we have this secret racism that is built around everything economically. And I don't know how to really get over it if we could just maybe improve our school.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much, Tom, for that call. Pam, Tom hits on a lot of different points, talked about transportation, access to food and how that substituting lower cost foods, lower quality foods can change people's health, too. And I mean, it's a really complicated system. How do we even begin to wrap our minds around it?
Thank you, Tom, for your call. And you did hit the nail right on the head. And I appreciate all of those factors of health that you brought up. How do we really have these conversations, and how do we extrapolate the power that's involved? And that is, again, is part of the narrative network that task force that I'm on. And, you know, I think that just as Tom identified, we have to have these discussions. We have to be challenged. And again, I brought up listening, active listening as a nurse. I've been trained for many years, and I'm now currently training our new nurses to really stop talking and to listen, actively listen, to understand what it is to have less opportunities. We talked about food deserts, as Tom brought up, as well as transportation issues. Those voices haven't been heard. We haven't provided or haven't allowed that power to listen and to make active changes so that we can make differences for overall health outcomes. When we talk about food deserts, as Tom referenced, what happens is that, you know, you're working two, three jobs if you're able to access a job that you can get to, and if there's, you know, adequate financing coming in so that a person can get to that job. And when you have food deserts, you are relying on the fast food industry that is centered in many of our areas of low income, both in low income areas such as in inner city Milwaukee, but also low income areas in rural northwestern Wisconsin. So you grab, you know, a fast food meal that costs less money. And Tom is right. Those health outcomes are poor. We see that in the diabetes. And also in our high stroke and our high cardiovascular disease rates that disproportionately affect people of color and negatively affect their overall health outcomes. And, you know, why should we be concerned about this? Well, it doesn't make economic sense, as in CENTS or in regular sense, SENSE, that we're not really looking at this from a perspective that allows everyone to get to the highest level of health and their overall well-being. Because when you feel good, when you're able to physically and mentally contribute back to the society, you help produce a much better, well-robusted economic entity. And that's needed for the state of Wisconsin as well as our entire nation.
Pam, we acknowledge that the data proves that there are disparities between white Wisconsinites and people of color. Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa, emailed to say, though, what am I supposed to do as a white person to help people you seem to be saying aren't really different from me after all? So having trouble understanding, you know, whether we have the same opportunities or we don't and how we work together there. What do you think?
Well, again, I would say that being willing to listen, being willing to reach out, find organizations, look at this declaration that the Wisconsin Public Health Association has identified, read, have conversations with neighbors. Let's talk about this and not be fearful or not be afraid to open up those conversations. And again, to have that active listening, to understand what it is like to not have the same opportunities to achieve the highest level of health and well-being. When I look at, again, the African-American percentages for leisure time physical activity in the past month, it's different at 38.2% that they've not had that ability versus whites at 27.7%. And so what does that mean? Can we be involved? Can we make a difference somehow in our own communities? Can we open up this conversation? Are you on a board of some type? Are you, you know, attending school board meetings? Are you part of the policy discussions that are going on? And just open up to have conversations, at least to get more of this out on the table, and then really commit to action.
All right. I appreciate you going into all of those areas to help us understand how we might be able to try to make a difference here. Pam, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for the conversation.
Pam Goodman is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Nursing and Sciences at UW-Eau Claire. She holds a doctorate in nursing practice, and we've been talking about how racism is a public health problem. Up next, we're looking at Wisconsin's school safety plans and guidelines intended to protect students and staff. Our guest explains how schools are using new funds to handle active shooter situations. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is The Morning Show. The University of Wisconsin system is looking for a new president. We learned less than 2 weeks ago that the search turned up a single finalist. And on Friday, that finalist withdrew his name. We're talking about the search, why the process and the candidate drew criticism, and how it affects students and employees around the state. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and we want to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. What are your thoughts about the only finalist dropping out? Maybe you're a UW student or you work someplace in the system. What is on your mind as we try to figure out what happens next? 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter. He's based in Wausau. Rich, thanks for talking with us again here on The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
And we know Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of UW-Madison. On Friday, Jim Johnson, currently president of the University of Alaska system, decided to take himself out of the running for the University of Wisconsin system president to replace Ray Cross. Why did he decide not to keep himself as a candidate?
Well, in my opinion, there's still a lot of unknowns about what played into that decision, but on paper, Jim Johnson basically said that, you know, there's a lot going on his campus with regard to COVID-19 and the financial challenges that they're dealing with up there, not unlike financial challenges that University of Wisconsin system is dealing with. But he just said that he was going to focus on that campus instead. And also he mentioned something that really surprised me, something he didn't have to put in this announcement of his, but he said that the UW system, Regents, you know, and the entire system obviously has process issues to work out. And that seemed to be a little bit of a burn, if you will, to the whole UW system president search process. And that is because a lot of faculty, staff, students were outraged that they weren't included on the actual committee that was tasked with picking and recommending a finalist to the full Board of Regents.
And before we learned about Johnson's withdrawal from consideration, I mean, you've been covering this. He was the only finalist for the job. Why was there just one finalist for this position?
Well, it depends who you ask. I mean, there's lots of theories among faculty members, you know, people that were suspicious of the process anyhow. But officially, Regent Michael Grebe, who was kind of the head of this special regent committee, is what they called it, the search committee. He said the reason was is they had lots of candidates, but they had multiple finalists. They never mentioned, and they have never mentioned how many people were initially interviewed or how many people were considered for the final selection. But Regent Grebe said on June 4th, that they had other people, but that the other people backed out right as their names were about to go public. And they said that was because of concerns about COVID-19. And essentially what they're saying is that, you know, these search committees, when you become a finalist, you know, there's a good chance that the institution that you are currently working for doesn't realize you're looking for another job. So Regent Grebe said that the concerns of these other people that could have potentially been finalists was that they would be outed as hunting for another job while there's a lot of craziness going on in terms of finances, COVID-19, at the institutions they serve right now. But, you know, some of the real, the faculty members in particular that are suspicious, shared governance, you know, faculty senate, staff senate, that have been suspicious about this process from the beginning, they kind of seem to believe that this single finalist might have been the favorite all along. This might have been like the predestined pick that the regents want to make, but there's absolutely no way to prove that.
We are talking with WPR's reporter in Eau Claire, Rich Kramer. He's covering higher ed for Wisconsin Public Radio, and he has been with us every step of the way working to figure out what happens in this search for a new president of the UW system and where we go next now that the finalist has withdrawn. We're taking your calls, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. And Mark from Mineral Point is ready to join the conversation. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi, what are you thinking about when we're talking about this search?
Yeah, I think there are two main things that need to be emphasized here. First, that this is a sort of a anti-democratic coup that happened in setting up the search committee. In the past, this goes back decades. There's a strong tradition of governance bodies, student governance bodies, faculty, academic staff, of them being the main people that make up a search committee. Over the years, this has deteriorated, and these very corrupt administrators have tried to hijack the whole system and take it over for themselves. And they've proven that they're too dishonest and too incompetent to find a good candidate. They just want somebody who also wants to undermine the academic quality of the UW system, cut all the core programs, liberal arts, and so on. And Jim Johnson is a total failed administrator. He's facing removal from the University of Alaska system. There have been countless no-confidence votes from the faculty, the staff, the students of University of Alaska. He's probably going to be removed, which explains why he is out there wandering around looking for a different job.
All right, Mark, a lot of different things to deal with there. We heard, Mark, critical not just of the candidate right now, but also of the search process, which we've heard, Rich, and also of this idea of just how the university system is run now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll start with the non-democratic coup part. What's happened is that since 2015, I mean, there have been small changes in regent policy, you know, the documents that guide what the regents do and how they make decisions for the UW system. There's been changes in state law since 2015, 2017, et cetera, that really open the door to change how these processes work in terms of searching, for leaders. The rule change in 2017 with regards to the UW president search literally says the president of the Board of Regents decides what it is. End of story. So Andrew Peterson, who is the current regent president, really had total control over how this whole process would work. And in terms of just the size, more to the point of the coup, there's been a real effort to change this process into more of a business-like procedure. There's been a lot of talk of wanting to hire chancellors and regent, you know, the presidents or other high level administrators who are not necessarily from academia, but from business backgrounds. And Jim Johnson, he's got a lot of business background. I mean, he's definitely been in academia for a little bit, but business and human resources was kind of his thing. So this has been a long time in the works. And just for an example, like past search committees for this one was about 9 members. And in the past, the search committee that hired Ray Cross, there was more like, double digits. It was like there used to be 20-some people on a search committee, and a lot of faculty, a lot of staff, a lot of students. But that just has changed now. They're taking more of a business-like kind of executive top-down approach to picking leaders.
What should we think about when it comes to this search during a pandemic? I mean, there are some big decisions ahead for UW System. And right now, because we don't have candidates, because we don't have somebody coming onto the job, who makes those?
That is the biggest question mark of all, in my opinion. The current UW president, Ray Cross, said that he was sending signals that he was going to retire this summer once they picked a person to replace him. There hasn't been, I'm kind of expecting some announcements out of the UW System Administration Office this week on this matter. I don't know if Ray Cross will stick around. I don't know if they're going to appoint an interim, but it does seem fairly obvious that the Board of Regents aren't going to be starting a new search process right now, because they did put out some statements saying that, we've got a lot of financial stuff to deal with right now. So they said that they're going to reconvene the search process and the search committee at a later date. So, and there was an editorial just recently in the State Journal talking about how there needs to be more transparency in the process, et cetera, et cetera. And that hopefully the regents have, quote unquote, learned their lesson. But that remains to be seen. And also, some of the, the board members might not feel like there was a lesson to be learned. There seems to be some anger at faculty, and there was a petition with over 2,000 signatures railing against Johnson, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss basically blamed the faculty and what he called leftist liberals on campus for intimidating Johnson into pulling out of the search. So there's some bad blood, and politics is not uncommon on campus or especially when it comes to funding, but there's a lot of distrust out there right now.
Yeah, and a lot of pointed language that people are using to explain their distrust. We're talking with Rich Kramer, who's a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and we're discussing the fact that UW System is unlikely to hire a new president anytime soon officially, because the only candidate who was an official finalist has removed his name from contention. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think the future will look like for UW System as we're dealing with a pandemic and trying to keep people farther apart to slow the spread of a contagious disease? What kind of leader does the university system need to support its students, faculty members, staff, and everybody else who's connected to campus? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tell us what's happening at the UW in your part of Wisconsin. There's a line for you, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show. The process of finding the next leader for Wisconsin State Universities has drawn criticism from the beginning. The committee was smaller than in the past. It included one person of color, and it didn't include any staff members or faculty representatives. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Voltina. Our guest is WPR reporter Rich Kramer. He covers higher education. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. What is your relationship to the UW system? Maybe you work on one of the campuses, or you take courses there. Maybe you're the parent of a college student. What do you want to see in the next person who leads the system? What kind of decisions do you want them to make? We'll also take your calls about what you're wondering about the search process at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Rich, talking a lot about the replacement process for Ray Cross, who announced, I believe, in October that he's stepping down as president. What does the UW system president actually do?
Well, they're kind of the big picture person. They're the ones that that kind of oversee the entire works. I mean, we've got 26 campuses, 13 universities. Used to be 26 colleges and universities, but that was kind of merged into one system, or merged in the restructure of 2017, 2018. Mm-hmm. But they oversee the business end of the university system. And, you know, right now, right before the finalist was mentioned for, you know, Jim Johnson was mentioned as the sole finalist, President Ray Cross put out a blueprint kind of outlining the way he sees the UW being most financially, you know, viable after the COVID-19 pandemic. And this blueprint basically calls for eliminating a lot of major degree programs, especially, you know, at the comprehensives, which is basically every university and branch campus other than UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee. You know, they don't say eliminate in the document. They talk about streamlining duplicate programs and reducing administrative, you know, overlap, you know, all these jargon terms. But in essence, they're talking about cuts, like big cuts coming in the next year. And even that plan was kind of, it wasn't dialed back, but once President Cross put it out there, there was strong pushback because a lot, you know, faculty, staff, students said they weren't involved at all in the creation of this document. But then, so this came out, the employees absorbed it, the students absorbed it, and they started giving feedback. And then the UW system seemed to backpedal a little bit. Ray Cross had a pretty aggressive timeline, and he has since backed away from that. But, you know, what's ironic is that the cuts that were proposed in this blueprint document are not entirely unlike what University of Alaska system's going through right now under the watch of Jim Johnson. In essence, all of higher education is really in a tough spot financially. And even before COVID-19 came, they were dealing with way less investment from the states. And then this pandemic came, and University of Wisconsin system, out of the gate, you know, spring and summer, they estimated they were going to lose $212 million. So the kind of financial peril they're in is really unprecedented. So that's also what really kind of cranks up the seriousness of this search, and the fact that there's kind of this vacuum in leadership, or maybe it perceived. I don't know if it really is, because again, President Cross could stick around, but sure. It's just a sure. Big question mark at a very serious time.
Well, I do wonder, how does this search for a system leader relate to enrollment? We've got public health restrictions, students trying to decide how to get their education while still staying safe. I mean, how does enrollment play into these decisions?
Student enrollment, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, man, it's huge. I mean, and I've seen some people kind of push back on the idea that there's declining enrollment. But if you look at the UW system numbers, they have been many campuses, especially the 2-year, what we call now the branch campuses, have seen huge reductions in enrollment. I mean, we're talking 30% and year over year. That's bad. That's bad news if you're a campus, because again, because of the declining share of state support within its overall budget over the decades, they're more reliant, almost like private colleges are. The UW institutions are more reliant on tuition revenue. So any changes now, or any you know, projected changes in enrollment, really force them into action. Right now, there's this idea that enrollment will start to really drop off after 2026, because there was a, you know, kind of a drop in the birth rate, you know, after the Great Recession. So they're watching a lot of these tea leaves that kind of don't bode well for the UW system. But also, what's been interesting along the way is a lot of times when they're talking about enrollment, excuse me, they're looking at numbers from 2010 as the benchmark. And that was a high watermark in terms of enrollment. I mean, that was in the midst of the, you know, just starting to climb out of the Great Recession. And generally during economic recessions, more people go back to school. So the enrollment numbers that they're comparing against are, you know, on the high end. But either way you look at it, they're losing enrollment, and that means a big drop in revenue for them.
And Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and we're talking about UW System's search for a new president and all of the twists and turns in that story as we try to figure out who will next take the lead for University of Wisconsin colleges and universities. Rich, the UW System president doesn't make all of these difficult decisions alone. There's the Board of Regents, which passes policies and rules for a lot of campuses. There are three new regents. Who are they, and how does the power structure work between the Board of Regents and the UW system so we know what's coming?
Right. The three new regents, off the top of my head, I only know of Ed Manydeeds because he is from the Eau Claire area, mm-hmm. and was actually one of the first people I met when I was getting into the news world of WPR. But they're Evers appointments. Tony Evers has appointed, five now total since last year, regents. And it's just like judges. You know, you think about like the Supreme Court. It's always a big deal when you talk about appointments because these people have – the UW system has 7-year terms, and a lot of people read into – you know, which governor appointed them. So former Governor Scott Walker, his regents had complete control of the board, other than a couple of what they call ex officio roles for, Stanford Taylor, Regent Stanford Taylor, who is the head of the Department of Public Instruction. And then there's another ex officio role that is head of the tech college system. So what you're going to see by next May is the Evers appointments take over. And what that means in terms of how or who follows what, because, again, the president, the system president's office kind of sets the policy. And then the regents in the last 8 years anyway have kind of supported that either through, you know, getting lobbying state government or passing changes in regent documents, advocating, et cetera. So it could be really interesting when you've still, especially if they were to have hired Jim Johnson, you would have someone who was picked by people that were appointed by Walker, while in the next year you'd have a majority of Evers appointments. And there was some speculation among some faculty members on social media that there could be some kind of a battle, you know, next year once the Evers, but who knows? That's all total speculation.
Sure. And there's so much more that will be coming out of this for certain, especially because it's such new news that the sole candidate who was a finalist has stepped down. So we'll pay attention to your reporting, Rich. We really appreciate you taking the time to catch us up on this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. I love talking Regents.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and we should mention that WPR is a service of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Coming up next is our state capitol report. We have the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, Consumer Protection and Trade, and we also have Attorney General Josh Call joining us. So get ready with your questions. You have a line to these officials here on the Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to this conversation on the Ideas Network.